Welcome back, listeners. My guest for this episode of the show is Angel Mays. Angel is the co-creator and co-host of Color Me Dead and the owner of the Low Carb Kitchen in Utah. She's our first returning guest, so I hope you enjoy the conversation. Color Me Dead. We'll get into that in just a moment. You're the first return guest I've ever had. I don't have to tell you what a huge honor this is, but thank you for doing the show.
Aw, no, thank you for including
me. Of course, yeah. Let's get right to it. In June of last summer, June of 21, I think, you and Nikki announced that you guys were going to end the show. Tell me why you made that decision.
You know, it is a full-time job to podcast. In fact, it's more than a full-time job. By the time you research something thoroughly and properly, record it, and then edit it, especially if you have two participants, two hosts with ADHD, it can be a chore.
Right.
And in order for us to make time to do the show the way we wanted it done, we just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I opened up my own meal prep business and it caught on like a house on fire.
Awesome.
Nikki is raising three gorgeous kids pretty much by herself. And anybody that is a mom knows being a mom is terribly hard. And, you know, she's running and gunning and works a full-time job. I was working two full-time jobs to get my business up off the ground. So the podcast really just fell to the wayside. So something that we loved, we absolutely still keep in touch with a lot of our listeners. It just wasn't going the direction we had hoped.
Is that difficult? I imagine I probably know the answer to this question already, but is that a difficult decision to make? Did you guys have a conversation about that, obviously, before you made the announcement? How was that? Was that hard to say goodbye to the show?
Oh, yes. We, neither of us could actually bring ourselves to do like a final departure episode.
Yeah.
We just let everybody know. We dropped it on our social media and just let them know, like, at this particular juncture, we both kind of felt like coming together as a team was getting harder and harder to be able to put out good content, not great content, even just good content was getting harder and harder.
Yeah.
And if I can't do something the very best that I can do it, then I don't want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's both an easy and difficult decision to make because you have like a, you know, you have, I mean, if it doesn't measure up to the quality you're used to doing, then you have to cut it loose, you know? And if it's, I know I can imagine how easy or how difficult that would be, you know, to make that decision. Well, something tells me you'll pop up on maybe another podcast at some point. You never know.
Maybe.
So, yeah. We'll see. There were a handful of things that we didn't get to talk about the first time around when you guys came on the show. The first thing I want to ask you about is, and I don't know how much you follow it or you don't, but the state of true crime podcasting today. What do you think shows like yours and others add to the assistance of helping solve some of these crimes, especially if you're investigating or helping to work on like an active investigation?
That's funny. I've been asked that before. I feel like when a team of investigators that do this over and over and over again, look for fresh eyes from somebody else, and especially us little armchair detectives, it's because we haven't had proper training, right? We're not investigators. We didn't go to school for that, but we pick up on little details that perhaps they overlooked because we ask questions looking at something. Well, why didn't we check that? Well, why don't you guys look at that? Mm-hmm. And they might have a valid, you know, well, in our experience, based on statistics, that's just not going to hold very much information, or that area wasn't necessarily entered. It's not part of our crime scene, but we might pick up on little things, whether it's, you know, a thumbprint somewhere and be like, you know, well, why is that way over there?
Right.
But I really think a lot of it pans into fresh eyes. They're looking at somebody that's thinking outside the box, some, you know, looking for facets of input that they wouldn't have thought of otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it a case? It's likely just a case of being too close. You're too close to the case and you sometimes miss things that are, that are right there in front of you, or you overlook, or you don't think are relevant. So,
right.
Is there something to be said about how a show approaches the way they cover cases, especially active ones? Like you and Nikki, you guys never pulled any of your punches. You covered these cases. You never compromised on how you did that. was that a conscious decision? And did you ever have like conversations about how you'd handle the coverage of something, especially if it was active?
Oh yeah. So we generally would not touch an open active case. And okay. The reason for that is most of the cases that we covered when people reached out to us had been closed and were later open for investigation.
Right.
Or reopened, I should say. But when something was open and active, the last thing I want to do is draw the wrong attention to that when the actual authorities are doing their investigation. We don't need a bunch of looky-loos around their crime scenes. We don't need to draw attention to a person, place, or thing that could be involved in like some doxing that then it compromises not only the place where a crime may have happened, but it could compromise the safety of a person who was once being looked at as a suspect, but isn't any longer.
Right.
And people have a tendency to hyperfixate on things, especially, you know, the droves and droves of true crime fans have a tendency to get sucked in just a little too much.
Yeah.
The documentary that was on Netflix, Don't F with Cats, is a prime example of just how dangerous it can be to touch on an open investigation because of how much attention you're drawing to person, place, or thing.
When do you think it's okay to move into the sphere of looking at a case like that? When is it? Is it when, you know, the FBI officially closes a case? We saw this with DB Cooper, right? Like the FBI closes the case and then everybody just loses their minds and they just go, they go crazy with trying to, well, I guess it's all, you know, it's all game now. We can go ahead and go hard on this and go as hard as we want. When is it okay to do that, in your opinion?
The only case that I've actually considered touching, which was still open, I reached out to the gentleman that was leading the investigation on that to ask him, if I cover this, is it going to make things harder, better? You know, what are your thoughts with this being open, and get the input from the lead person on the investigation. Otherwise, if there has been a person charged and convicted, it's open. If the police, the local authorities, FBI, if they shut the if they close it, game on. Otherwise, I like to speak with especially the family of any victims or suspects, because the last thing I want to do is draw unnecessary attention to them when they're already having to deal with so much.
Is the situation different, or is it really a lot of the same? If it's like if there's a disappearance involved, for instance, they might have custody of a particular perp or someone that's responsible or they think is responsible, or they might not have, and they still have no answers in the case. I mean, is a disappearance case, does it have special circumstances?
Not necessarily. I just want to make sure, I would say the honest to God, the only special circumstance is little kids.
Yeah.
I have a different set of rules when I cover cases of kids.
Right. What are those rules? Do you mind sharing those rules? Like, is there something special you have to take into consideration there?
Because I had the mother of a victim reach out to me after I covered her kid, I will do my very best to reach out to a parent and make sure that they are through their grieving process, that I'm not picking scabs of old wounds, and that I'm not giving information that the family doesn't want shared, even if it is public record.
Right.
I don't want to say or do anything that could like create a buzz and have people talking about it again. Mm-hmm. And especially in small towns like where I live, I don't want somebody, you know, standing in line at Walmart waiting to get a bag of popcorn and hear, oh my gosh, did you hear that Color Me Dead? They covered this child murder and they're talking about your kid.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. You never know who's listening or who's going to overhear something.
You don't.
Yeah. I mean, so for we talk about some of the potential consequences of covering a case, but there's so many, obviously there's so many murders in this country almost, you know, on a daily basis. There's so many unsolved cases. On the flip side of that, do podcasts, do they add a service, or do they add a benefit to a case that's maybe not been picked up by the public and not of this big ridiculous thing that everybody's sort of looking into, as being, you know, covered by primetime news and things of that nature? Does a podcast like yours and like others, does that actually help in those cases, in those instances?
I believe so. It turns into a Hands Across America, where one person way over in New Jersey can be talking about, hey man, you know, my cousin was murdered, that we don't have justice. I want this looked at. I don't think it was handled properly.
Right.
And all you have to do is give that to one podcast that has 500 people listening.
Right.
Because as soon as you do, those 500 people tell 500 more and 500 more. And it's just... Yeah. It's like filling the bucket and pretty soon it's overflowing. So it works out well.
Yeah. Does it have to do with, you know, just the idea of social media and helping sort of, I feel like social media is obviously it's a double-edged sword. I think in certain cases it can be fantastic. I've seen like social media threads, Twitter threads, especially where people like are trying to track down a specific perp or something like that. And they get it done. Like it's pretty amazing how something spreads like wildfire and they can actually have a solution. Is that, I guess the social media help or hinder? Is it a double-edged sword? Are there pros and cons? I'm sure there's probably pros and cons.
I'm going to go with pros and cons.
Yeah,
for sure. There's good and bad parts to true crime.
Right.
And especially when you're getting fans involved,
right.
The ability to spread knowledge and awareness, bring light to a case, all good things. And it's all free.
Yeah.
You know, you're not hiring private investigators. You're not hiring a team of people to gather your information or spread your information. It's all free. Mm. However, people have especially like the younger community,
right.
They have a problem with embellishing.
Yeah,
and I know this because I have two younger people that I have raised.
Yeah.
And they, you know, did you hear about this? No, let me tell you about it. And they add 10% and they add 10%. Right. And pretty soon we have a little bit of truth on mm-hmm. a case that did need to be put into a spotlight so that we can bring some more foot traffic to solving it, getting a little bit of justice. But in the meantime, you have also created a little bit of an urban legend.
Yeah,
where there's going to be facets of it that aren't necessarily accurate.
You know, the first time you were on the show, we spoke about some of the most difficult cases you guys covered for mm-hmm. Color Me Dead. Now I want to ask you about maybe some of the cases, and there might not be any, but I would imagine there probably is one or two. Some of the cases that you never covered for the show, were there stories you wanted to tell? Were there cases or a case specifically that you wanted to get to but never could?
So many.
Are there?
So many. Oh, yeah. There were some cases that we had, you know, binders full of, we're going to do this next. We're going to do this next. We can do this one. I was gearing up to start a bit on Joseph Metheny, who killed people and then supposedly put them in his barbecue.
Good Lord.
And sold that at a little, yeah, like on the side of the road. So you could have been having a barbecued people burrito.
Oh God.
You don't know. But yeah. And he's a terrible, disgusting looking human being on top of all that. I don't know why anybody would exchange money with this gentleman for food, especially if he had touched it. But according to his charges, that was something I always liked, the ones that'll make people stop and be like, oh my God, did I get there? Was I there? Yeah. Did I do that? Did I participate in that? But yeah, there's quite a few that we never got to.
Wow. Do you have you just mentioned one, but do you have a passion case? Is there a case that you always come back to or that you just can't let go of?
I do. It's actually not many people will know this one, but we covered the story of a little baby. Her name was Brianna. It's the hardest case I've ever covered.
Yeah.
She was 153 days old when she died, and she suffered horribly at the hands of her mom, her biological father, and her uncle. Her mom has since been released from prison and was given a whole new identity so that she could integrate back into society. And nobody ever know who she was. And I struggle with that.
Yeah, me too. Jesus.
I don't think it's fair that when you know, abuse, mutilate, and take part in the murder of a little baby that's 153 days old, I don't think you get to start over in my book. You get to stay the same piece of crud that you always were, you tire fire, and everybody gets to know.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. That one's always in the forefront of my brain.
Yeah. You know, you just talked about a couple questions back, like about having binders full of information for research for cases that you guys never got a chance to cover. For people listening that want a podcast, maybe want to get into true crime or really any genre that's really heavy, that's really difficult to cover, requires a lot of research. Can you talk a little bit about the research that you guys did for these cases? I mean, so many people just hear the show and they think it's just two people, you know, going back and forth and having a conversation and just kind of making some interesting points, but they don't realize everything that goes into or leads into that moment. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, you know, that process and how much time and effort you guys actually put into these cases?
So depending on how much information is available, it can take a week, week and a half, because I like to get everything. So for an example, when we did Gypsy Rose Blanchard, because everybody's very familiar with that, right?
Yeah.
I go and I read every single blog that's available. I read every single book that has been written. I'll watch every single documentary, whether it's made for TV, drama, or actual documentary. Mm-hmm. So it's about 40 to 55 hours worth of legitimate reading, research, watching, taking notes for something that's bigger, like when we did Pee Wee Gaskins or when we did Dahmer. That's multiple books, and these books are anywhere from 250 pages, which is a drop in the bucket, to almanacs on these serial killers that are, you know, 500 and 600 pages. It takes us a while to put that stuff together. Yeah.
You know, I don't think I might have asked you this the first time. Maybe not. Why do you think the world is so fascinated with serial killers?
Everybody is. I actually have a book called The Invention of Murder. It's a great book. It's like the forbidden fruit. You're not supposed to talk about murder. You're not supposed to be interested in murder. Right. You're not supposed to. So not only do people find that interesting, but murder itself and what it takes to actually complete that task, I think most people are interested in.
Well, speaking of, I guess just for some fun speculation, if you guys relaunched the show tomorrow, what would you guys change? Would you change anything about the show?
I would probably work on the language because I cuss a lot, and I know that can be very off-putting to some listeners.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I would try to stay on task a little bit more as well, because I have a tendency to jump away from the information sitting right in front of me and want to talk about 30 other things.
Same.
But I struggle with that. But beyond that, no, I think that we actually did something that a lot of podcasts shied away from, which is I told you everything.
Right.
You know, some podcasts in true crime would be like, you know, and then he hurt her with a very sharp implement, but we won't go into that. I will.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you exactly what he did.
Yeah.
If you're listening to true crime, I feel like there are no boundaries. If you purposefully tune into something about being murdered, especially somebody that did it more than once, you should know that you're getting into something pretty heavy.
Right. Yeah. Well, speaking of that, you know, I want to walk through something that we weren't able to talk about previously, probably because I hadn't thought about it, but I have now. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong with this. I'm trying to struggle to get this out. I feel like there are different levels to true crime podcasting and the crimes themselves, really. So when you think about someone like Ted Bundy or Zodiac or someone like that, there's almost a layer to those cases because they're so famous, you know, books and movies and all that stuff. But other cases like the Delphi murders or some of these other cases are much more volatile because they're obviously highly open and active investigations. I feel like certain cases maybe move from one position to another once they become either cold or the public sort of becomes disinterested. Am I wrong in my assumption? Do cases like Zodiac or like Jack the Ripper even become more about the mystery and finding out who the person was rather than where the focus should be? And that's on the victims and the crimes of these individuals.
Always, always. It's always, you know, talking about like H.H. Holmes. Right.
Yeah.
Sure. We should focus on the victims and their families and how they recovered and that kind of thing. But then everybody wants to get right back into why he did it, how he got away with it, how many rooms were in that weird little, you know, it wasn't very little, but that weird
murder
home.
Castle. Yeah. For lack of a better term.
Murder castle. That's right. Yeah. And then people are like, oh my God, well, maybe H.H. Holmes was Jack the Ripper. And then everybody's got an idea on who, what, when, where, and why, and everything that happened to people subsequently just kind of fall to the wayside. Same thing happened to like Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. Then it becomes, you know, oh my God, nobody's safe. Not what happened to the victims or who the victims were, but like, he doesn't have an MO. It's not just, you know, petite Asian ladies with, you know, X, Y, and Z dress, you know. No, it was anyone and everyone. And then we start focusing on the killer and not the victim. But, and then it's always, you know, well, I would have done it this way. I bet you would have, you know, there's always got to be somebody.
Yeah. Richard Ramirez was particularly insane because
none.
Yeah. There was no type. There was nothing. It was, it was truly just random. And that's scary. I mean, I feel like Zodiac was, he definitely had I feel like he had more of a type, but Zodiac was pretty terrifying too, because it, because of the gap and, you know, the lull between what happened in the original, potentially the original murder, the one that took place in Riverside, right, and then all the way up north and everything. It's pretty amazing. We'll have plenty of time to get into Zodiac on other shows. As podcasters, you know, I feel like we're trying to tell stories that are interesting and entertaining, because let's not forget, at the end of the day, as horrible as some of this content may be to cover, we're trying to deliver a form of entertainment here, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. When a podcaster involves themselves with a victim's family or a victim even, what is the switch in the mindset there? Must you change your approach and the way you handle the show because of that fact, or can you deal with every case you cover, no matter who's involved, with sort of like a blanket approach?
I would probably have a different mindset about this if it were like my family or somebody very close to me.
Right.
Would I still cover it? Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, we talked a little bit about true crime. It's a billion-dollar industry now. Documentaries, podcasting, conventions, merchandising. Is that a bad thing? Are we asking the right questions here? Like, you know, should something like this be turned into an industry, so to speak? You know, like in the same way that like sneakers are, or some shit like that, you know?
It doesn't bother me.
Right.
However, I actually have a friend who is a murderabilia aficionado. He was actually on a talk show back in the 90s for being the collector of murderabilia, and how wrong people like Mr. Walsh, whose kid was abducted and later murdered, had a really negative, bad taste in his mouth about it,
right,
obviously.
Right.
But for somebody like me, I know that he has written to, collects letters, artwork, and other things, including personal belongings of serial killers. He's got warehouses full of it.
Yeah.
People find it sick that he makes money that way. And I'm like, everybody's got a price. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He just found it this way. And I don't know if people are going to want it. People are going to get it. They're going to look for it anyway. It might as well come from me.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's a good way.
I guess
to
it would be
it.
Different if somebody else was like, oh my God, I got the backpack of this little kid that was murdered, and it was like my niece. Mm-hmm. I'd be like, hey, shit.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, I'm sure I would have a different feeling about it.
Yeah. Well, when we see some of that, you know, I'm kind of stretching here, but we're seeing some of that in some of the historical cold cases that we cover for Vanished, and like, for instance, a concrete example would be the vertebrae of John Wilkes Booth that is in one of the museums back east. The whole idea that John Wilkes Booth maybe didn't die that night in the barn, and that maybe it's someone else there. Well, they can excavate a body, they can compare it to that particular vertebrae, and they can match DNA, and if it matches, that's obviously Booth. If it doesn't, it's not Booth, or we got a problem here. There's a lot of people that sort of like will look at that and be like, well, you know, we shouldn't, you know, history's written, we shouldn't touch it. But I feel like we have a historical and almost a moral obligation to be able to, hey, if history is written incorrectly, we have a right to be able to tell that, to write that wrong and to rewrite history, so to speak. And so, like, I feel like, you know, with some of these, the true crime cases, people are maybe holding out evidence or holding something very vital or very important, and they don't want to share it, or they, whatever the case is. And that can cause problems too, I think, you know, especially for people who are trying to investigate and trying to figure out what's going on and try to get answers for these families. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's kind of I know it's a little bit of a stretch, but it's historical stuff is a little different, I guess, but
you are correct. Like if somebody purchases that and it is now theirs, they, by all rights, this is mine. But right. It pertains to a case that could bring another facet of completion.
Mm-hmm.
Do we let him keep it? Because that's,
Do you step in? That's very true. D.B. Cooper and the tie, you know, they have D.B. Cooper's tie. You know, mm-hmm. they've actually let some citizen sleuths. I mean, some very well respected and very good, you know, top of the mark in their field citizen sleuths look at the tie and actually do DNA testing on the tie and stuff like that. I feel like that's how you sometimes can help solve, going back to the original question I asked you, is that's how you can sometimes help solve these cases, is mm-hmm. you get a fresh set of eyes on it. You get somebody mm-hmm. that maybe is an expert in that field that's not well known or it's not associated with the case to come out of left field and sort of look at this with no iron in the fire. That's what we did with Earhart, with bringing Jen into she didn't know anything about really the case, but she was a defense attorney. That was her expertise. So that's kind of why I think it was so beneficial to have her on the show, you know, to do that.
Right.
So do we ever get more Color Me Dead? I know that's a very loaded question, but do we ever get more Color Me Dead? Is that possible?
Perhaps. It's not going to be anytime soon, that's for sure. But I know that I mean, once you're an entertainer and you podcast and you have that thirst and that drive, I think it's always there. It's creating the time to continue your hobby. I've been asked to sit in on a couple of different shows. And that's been nice because it gives me the opportunity to banter back and forth and get that taste back in my mouth. Because I eventually would like to hire a staff to take care of the things at the kitchen. And if that takes place and frees up to where then I'm just a supervisor, I'll probably continue forward with podcast. I don't know if it'll be Color Me Dead, but.
Well, let's talk about the low carb kitchen. Cause you touched on the beginning, like where you've gone next and what you're doing now. Tell me about how that came about and what you're doing there.
So in 2016, I was class 2 morbidly obese and decided to do something about that. And I started ketogenics and I was white knuckling it. I was guessing like most people do. And I would lose weight, gain it, lose, gain, lose, gain. It was my favorite game, you know, the fat, thin Oprah thing. And it was awesome. Anyway, I finally got to a point where I was like, all right, I need an actual education. So I went, I took some courses. I did get a nutritional certificate that says I'm SMART. I started meal prepping for myself and making food for myself because there are lots of avenues to purchase things online. And some of that I did. It's very expensive. And some of it tastes like kitty potty box sand. And I don't ever want to put bad food in my mouth that I paid all that money for. So I was like, you know what? I'll just figure it out myself. When people saw that I lost over 100 pounds and I was still eating pancakes and cupcakes, they were like, here's some money. You do mine too. And so I got voluntold that I was going to help some friends and family. Eventually, I outgrew my house. For those that don't know, I have a small petting zoo. And it's one thing for me to be like, ew, is that a feather? Gross. But it's quite another for somebody who pays me to be like, is that a feather? Like, sorry.
Yeah.
So I ended up buying a whole extra location. I have weekly meal prep clients who pick up their stuff every week and that's all they eat. I have some people that just pop in for the occasional goodie. But I cater to people who are diabetic, people that have autoimmune issues, whether they have, you know, thyroid problems or celiac disease. I do sugar-free, gluten-free, grain-free, everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Wow. Well, that's great. Congratulations on that. That's really great. I follow it on Instagram and I always see your stuff and it looks really good. So maybe we'll place an order. Do you ship out orders? Do you put stuff
out? Right now, I can do like shelf stable items. So my baked goods, we're in the process of trying to sort out shipping for our frozen stuff. In the wintertime, it's awesome because everything stays frozen anyway. But we're coming up on those fun summer months. So the shipping can be a little bit of a problem. And especially if you're not shipping out in massive wholesale quantities.
We look forward to seeing what comes of that next. All right. Well, before we sort of wrap things up and sort of get out of here tonight, if you know the show, you know, I'm a fan of having my guests sometimes run through uncomfortable questionnaires at the end of our show.
Oh.
And so you don't know this. Nobody will know this. Well, I guess everybody who listens to the show who will guest will now know this. You're the guinea pig.
Okay.
We did this for season one and we're going to continue the tradition now. This questionnaire is the same one that guests on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert do. I don't know if you've heard it yet, but there are actually 16 rapid fire questions. One special one for you.
Okay.
You ready for this?
I am.
The first one's right up your alley. Angel, what is the best sandwich?
Peanut butter and jelly with Lay's potato chips, the original, smash in between.
That is a fantastic first answer. Okay, what is the one thing you own that you really should throw out?
My kids.
Agreed. What is the scariest animal?
A raccoon.
Yeah, really? Well, yeah, they are pretty scary.
No, they're sketchy and aggressive and they look cute, so they fool you into getting too close.
Yeah, that's very true. And they attack. All right. Apples and oranges, or apples or oranges, I should say.
Apples.
All right. Have you ever asked someone for their autograph?
Yes.
Who was it?
Jason Momoa.
Oh, did you get it? You got
it? I did.
Did you get a picture? Did you get a picture with him?
I do.
My wife would, I think every woman probably.
He smells like book leather, vanilla, and whiskey. It's the most amazing thing I've ever smelled in my life.
Just like you would expect him to smell, I would imagine.
It was beautiful.
Yes, I'm sure it was. What do you think happens when we die?
I'm going to say that you get to choose. You can either go to your afterlife and live on whatever little cloud with your harp and your wings, or you can be reborn.
Yeah. I love those options. Favorite action movie?
The Last Boy Scout with Bruce Willis. Ooh,
good pick. That's a deep cut. That's a really good pick. Favorite smell?
I love the smell of cow manure, and please let me explain.
Yes, you're going to have to.
I live in the middle of nowhere where it's a lot of dairy farms. And so you always know when you're close to home, when you can smell cattle. And so that is a very nostalgic. I know that I'm close to home when I can smell cow poop.
It's a positive trigger smell. Yeah, I get it. What about the opposite? Least favorite smell?
Tommy Girl. Perfume. It was
That was big back in the day.
Way too popular, and everybody wore it in 9 squirts. And it's a very musky gardenia smell, and I can taste it now.
I would say the same thing for like CK1.
CK1.
Oh God. Yeah. My girlfriend I was dating like in junior high got me that for Christmas, and I'll never forget that smell. It's just like
for
him
or her. No. And everybody wore it, and they wore it so heavily that it, like, I'm pretty sure I have brain damage because of it.
I think I still got some leftover cool water upstairs from back in the day too. Like, that's still, you know, I hit myself with that every time I really want to impress the wife, you know, when we go out.
Hey.
Yeah. All right. Is exercise worth it?
Yes.
I would agree. I think so.
Not just so you can look good naked, but it's also like nature's cure for depression or like treatment for depression. And I know that, you know, like getting up and actually exercising is on the bottom of my to-do list. But once I do it, I feel so much better. I'm like, see, this is why we're supposed to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. Flat or sparkling?
Flat.
Yeah, I'm a sparkling. Well, no, that's actually, I'll take that back. I probably agree with you. Flat, I think, is sparkling's a little weird tasting.
It freaks me out. And like every time I see somebody crack open a LaCroix with the smile on their face, I have to wonder if they're like ill.
Yeah.
Because they're it tastes just like coconut watermelon. No, it doesn't. It tastes like two bums drank a watermelon and a coconut, pissed through a shoe, and put it in a bottle for you.
Absolutely. I agree. All right. We're going to play that. We're going to play that clip as an audio clip for everybody who disagrees with us. Okay. what is the most used app on your phone?
Facebook.
No. Okay. Facebook. Don't tell your husband. I'm just kidding. He's a very large man. So I don't want to piss him off. Okay. You only get one song to listen to for the rest of your life. What is that song?
Just Looking by the Stereophonics.
Okay. Wow, you're getting choosing some deep cuts here. Tonight.
That is like my all-time favorite. Like, if I was stuck in an elevator and that's the only song that was going to play, let it be that one.
Yes. All right. Here's a fun one. What number am I thinking of?
69, dude.
No, 69. I knew you were going to go to that. Why did I know you're going to go to that? I'm all right. Dead. That's okay. Nobody. Yeah, that's true. Nobody's going to guess my number, I don't think. I'm going to keep asking that question every episode. Okay. How many times have you been booted off social media for violating standards?
To date?
Yeah.
29.
Oh my, you're counting. I knew you were counting. Well, how did I know you'd know that answer?
I actually had my Instagram account completely disabled and taken away from me recently. That was a doozer. So
they
now
keep picking on you.
I know, but I'm on a watch list. Like, it's like when you Google how to make chloroform one time and then you're on the watch list. I have to be very, very careful about what I say because the algorithm picks up on everything I say. I told my brother once that if he didn't stop being mean to me, I was going to punch him in his fucking potato face and caught like a 30-day ban. And I was like, that's, it's so my brother. Stupid. How are you going to be upset with me? Sorry, I said the F word. I was just like, you can't be hyperbolic. Mm-hmm. I said that I would burn down HBO studios if they didn't make part 2 of Dune.
Boom. Right.
30-day ban.
Valid reason.
She's starting fires.
Right. Valid reason. Yeah. Okay. Well, the last question, maybe the most interesting one. Describe the rest of your life in 5 words.
Perfectly chaotic, but also beautiful. Yeah.
I love that. That's great. Tell everybody where can we follow you online? Can we follow the kitchen online? Where can we find it?
Absolutely. If you're interested in watching my food, you can do that at thelowcarbkitchen.utah.
All right. I like .utah. And it's, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, .utah, because there are several low carb kitchens. My favorite ones in Scotland, they have a beautiful idea of food. I'm not sure that I'm that adventurous because some of it looks like a dare. But I would like to be able to go and visit their kitchen. So, Utah.
We'll have links to everything we talked about in the show notes tonight. Angel, thank you for doing this. I mean, this was a lot of fun, and I look forward to talking with you more in the future.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm always happy to be included.
Another conversation behind us. Thanks for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you enjoy the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air. News, show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/ me and my friends pod. On Twitter, you can search the handle me my friends pod. And on Instagram, search the handle me and my friends pod. If you enjoyed the conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher and rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. The show's music is created and performed by producer Riddiman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Eben Films Incorporated. Chris Eben Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Eben Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Eben Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Eben Films production, copyright 2022. All rights reserved.